Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show where we demonstrate that everything, and I mean simply everything, has its own history. Like duvets, grass, and avocados.
Or, Sam, print, flint, and the hint. So the hint is all about subtly suggesting things. Do you think you should have an extra slice of cake, Professor Daybell? It's actually the history of passive aggression, which I think would be great. Or lint, mint, and skint. So skint is all about the history of being broke. It's about poverty, and I'm sure this is something that relates, people can relate to during lockdown. However, this is to digress because we will be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example? Who knew, Sam? Well, you did. But the history of nicknames is, in fact, all about the Vikings. Politics, the history of marriage, and childhood. I had some very evil children with me at school who were merciless in their nicknaming of me. Or that the history of leather is all about exploration, transatlantic gender relations, it's about Iberian sheep, and it's about being given £5 and being told to go out and buy something interesting.
What?
Yes, did you know that there is in fact a National Leather Museum, which is based in Northampton, and it was started by the most remarkable man who gave his staff each a wad of cash and basically said, go out and buy interesting leathery things.
Oh, that's so cool.
They did, and the museum is simply stuffed with them. And I want to do an episode on leather. And of course, leather, the history of leather, how could we forget, is all about gloves.
It is, absolutely. I came across a wonderful glove quote the other day. I've just realised I need to send it to
you. Oh, yes, please.
For our new listeners, we've had so many recently. James is obsessed with the history of gloves. You will discover that as you listen to our podcasts. Anyway, I should introduce him, really. The man, he's not sitting opposite me because we're still recording at the other end of town because we're social distancing. Anyway, he is, let's call him the Freddy Krueger of history.
Thank you.
It's Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. I'm slightly terrified of those Nightmare on Elm Street movies. I remember sitting in form time at school and having them described to me in vivid, vivid detail. And I have to say, I have never seen them because I'm far too fearful. However, the man not sitting opposite me, because we haven't dared get into the cramped space of our recording studio, and he is across town. He is the historical gladiator of the archives, the man who puts the fear of God into other historians. So sharpened and honed is his trident of historical inquiry. Yes, it's the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis. Willis, even. Gosh, that was quite
a
mouthful.
That was so good. Apart from the last bit.
Yes. I obviously need another drink of coffee this morning.
I think you might do. Hello, everyone. It's really nice to be back. We have had a bit of a break because of the hiatus of the world and COVID-19, but we're back now and we are going to be carrying on. We'll be releasing an episode a week. I very much hope you got stuck into our homeschooling specials we did during lockdown to help all of you trapped kids and trapped adults with trying to understand the world of the past in a new way. Really enjoyed doing those, and they're great fun to listen back to. But we're going to be carrying on now doing traditional histories of the unexpected episodes in which we will take something that you don't suspect has a history and we will prove that it does. And today we're doing something that James and I have both wanted to do for some time. And I think it's particularly appropriate to be doing it now because, well, the world seems to be full of fear. at the moment. There's a great deal going on in the news, and there's a lot of people sitting at home being fearful about what they're reading in the news. So we thought it would be a good time to do the history of fear. James, I think this is one of your ideas, wasn't it?
It was one of my ideas, yes, yes. And I have had a very busy time during lockdown, and I have been reading all sorts of stuff, and I am stuffed full of history, and I am just itching to disgorge it in podcast form. I've been reading about all sorts of things, mainly to do with gloves, but there's lots there. But yes, this history of fear is something that I've been wanting to do for a very long time. It's something that's very, of the moment, as you said. I mean, not only because of the COVID pandemic, and I think people are quite rightly fearful, but also because of global warming, which is frankly terrifying in itself. I think also when we look at what is happening in the political world today, the social media world, the sort of world of popular politics, I think fear is being used as a political weapon to mould and to shape and to influence voters around the world in really in ways that are terrifying, but also that are fascinating to the political and historical observer. You just need to look at what's going on in America. And I'm a very avid viewer of what's going on in the presidential campaign there. And what was interesting looking at the Republican convention was the way in which fear is being peddled to the masses there. You listen to that sort of couple of days, and it's the way that they are demonizing the Democrats. We're not taking any sort of political standpoint here. This is just an observation. But the way in which the Democrats are being demonized, the way in which they're being pigeonholed in a particular way, the way in which a lot of the violence that's on the street is being, is being leveled at Biden. It's just extraordinary to sort of think of that. So that was one of the things that, or those were sort of three of the things, I suppose, that led us to sort of think about doing something on the history of fear. And in particular, I've been reading a book by Joanna Bourke called Fear, A Cultural History, which really got me wanting to do something on the history of fear. I'm partly reading this for another project that I'm developing at the moment, but it is a fantastic cultural history of fear over the long 20th century in Britain and America. The long 20th century basically means it bleeds into the 21st century. So there's all sorts of stuff about 9/11 and terrorism threats, but also it sort of goes back into the 19th century. So it's a culturally capacious way of looking at a topic over a broad period. And what it argues is that fear is a hugely pervasive emotion, and one that has a really profound and entangled history. And it connects to all sorts of other emotions, such as jealousy and dread and consternation and surprise. And it's very hard to unentangle. I think one of the big powerful things coming out of it is that it charts a shift over the long 20th century, one that essentially sees in the past people having fearing for others, so this kind of more paternalistic sort of thought about fear, fearing of what will happen to others, a move towards, in the 20th century, the fearing of others. And we can see this in various ways. And I've already talked about the way in which the alt-right in the United States are doing this today. But also, if you have a look at the way in which something like, the way in which feminism was demonized and targeted in the 50s and 60s. I've just finished watching the brilliant televisation of Mrs. America, which was quite extraordinary. And there what you have is alt-right conservative women who go up against feminists who basically want to pass an equality act. And the way in which they go about that is to absolutely demonize the feminist cause and really totally misrepresent them, seeing it as sort of behind the disintegration of America. But I think fear isn't something that's necessarily a new thing. Well, it's not necessarily a new thing. It's something that has been there throughout throughout history. You know, you think about the demonization, the fear of others, whether it be witches, whether it be women, whether it be people of different ethnic or religious backgrounds or people with different sexual orientations. It's always been there. But what the book does, it argues, especially in the light of the kinds of sanctioned torture of terrorists that we've seen, it argues, and I'm quoting here, authoritarian, indiscriminate and disproportionate responses have become the norm. Public policy and private lives have become fear-bound. Fear has become the emotion through which public life is administered. It is time we return to a politics which feared for the lives of others near and far. Although fear is humanity's inheritance, trembling is our testament. We must always tremble in the face of the stranger glimpsed beneath the rubble of history. So it's a real kind of clarion call for a sort of, you know, socially minded form of history. Now, the book is really wide ranging in what it looks at. What it doesn't do is look at things like arachnophobia and the fear induced by horror films or roller coaster rides or extreme sports. Instead, it's organized into five main themes. And it starts by looking at prevailing fears and anxieties. So those kind of underlying things that are just shot through society. So fear of death and fear of disasters. It then moves to look at an individual response to fear. So it looks at childhood fears, nightmares, phobias. And central here, because I think there's a form of quite sophisticated psychohistory here, it's actually understanding those different fears from a psychological point of view. Part three looks at mass media's role in inciting panic, so social hysteria and fear. And then section four looks at military threats. And this is a fascinating part of the book where we have a look at the shift in fear in terms of combat, cities under siege and bombardment. And then this sort of something that happened in the second half of the 20th century. It's this fear of nuclear threat. And then there's also realms of anxiety. This is the final part of the book where it looks at contemporary fears with crime, disease, pain, the environment, and also how fear manifests itself on the body. And it ends with the discussion of terrorism and globalism, globalization of risk. So it's a hugely wide-ranging book with massive themes that run throughout it about how we define fear, that fear isn't something that is universal, but is something that is distinct within particular periods. There's a prevalence of war in the book. So 3 out of the 11 chapters are on war. It charts a really fascinating shift from religious fear to scientific fear. So effectively, what you have is fear of God and what God will do if you behave in a particular way, to fear of microbes and germs. It also, and I was very interested to read this in light of some of your interests, Sam, it also talks about the face of fear. So, and talks about Guillaume Duchenne's experiments, the electrocution in the face and the way in which the emotion of fear was expressed in visual form. So there we are. There's a sort of little two-penneth to start with on the cultural history of fear. But you should all go out and read this. Joanna Bourke's Fear, A Cultural History.
Well, I mean, as always, we both like to start with what we're kind of doing at the moment. And it's interesting that you're doing that for another project. I just made a little list of what I've been doing over the last 3 or 4 months. And one of the things that struck me is that a theme which links all of them, surprisingly, is fear. So this is just a little brief idea of what I've been doing over the last few months, give you a sense of what it's like being a jobbing public historian. I've written an introduction to a series of books which are going to be published by the British Library on highwaymen, pirates and rogues. We're reprinting a beautiful first edition of a book of criminal biography, which the British Library have. And that's a really interesting book, which makes you think about the public popularity of dangerous people, essentially. And I think the way that the public dealt with that, the readers dealt with that, was a way of kind of assuaging their own fear of what these people brought to society. I've got a wonderful list here We've done the Highwaymen. I've done my Pirates one. So the next one I'm writing an introduction on is on Rogue. So they're sort of not Highwaymen. They're not Pirates. They're something else. Here we have Sawney Bean. He's described as a robber and a cannibal. The Waltham Blacks, they're deer stealers. Who else have we got? John Collins, a general thief. James Filewood, what a wonderful name, pickpocket. Robert Fuchs is a murderer. Anne Harris, oh, a female swindler. That's going to be interesting. Nan Herford, also a female swindler. Anne Holland, a pickpocket. Louis Hussart, a murderer. And it goes on and on with a huge variety of thieves and robbers and murderers. And so that's one aspect of what I've been looking at. And part of what we do here on Histories of the Unexpected is to open windows into the various ways you can think about these themes in history. So I just wanted to make the first point that there's a fascinating early first quarter of the 18th century changing business in the world of publishing, where it's like the early history of true crime suddenly comes about. And these... a lot of these are crimes against property. Don't forget that. But at the same time, a crime against property can be punishing, be punished by being hanged. So there is a very vivid and growing interest, which is making some publishers a huge amount of money of the public in their own fear about the challenges to society brought about by all of these criminals. Now, as well as that, I've done a fair few bits of filming. And listen to this for a ramble of stuff I've had to talk about, James. I've had to talk about the history of ghosts, werewolves, the curse of Tutankhamun, the Great Flood, and Atlantis, Hadrian's Wall, the Great Wall of China, Gothic cathedrals and castles, among other things.
You've done all of those?
Yes.
During lockdown?
Yes.
Goodness me.
It's completely ridiculous. But there's a really interesting theme in the idea that fear actually links all of these together. Any of those you'd like to hear about particularly, James?
Castles.
Castles? Okay, well, we've talked about castles before. Well, essentially...
Well, you pick. I'm just a nerd.
I will briefly say something about castles. The idea here is that the Normans invade England in 1066, and then they set about building castles in very noticeable places all over the landscape. It's a culture of fear, it's a culture of oppression, to prove that there are new masters in town. They're making a symbolic statement about who is in charge, and they want to instill a sense of fear, a sense of obedience, and a sense of control throughout the country. So that's your link of fear with castles. I was quite interested in the Great Flood. Talking about the history of the Great Flood, and people actually, there's a fascinating history of people actually searching for what they believe to be Noah's Ark, that's a real history in itself. The real history of people trying to find the Ark. Then there's an interesting theological history about the Ark, what it means to why it actually features, and one aspect of it I've become really interested in is this idea of so many cultures in the ancient world living by the sea or living by water. As you know, that I started my life as a maritime and naval historian, and this idea of water is really kind of fundamental to my whole business of being a historian. So why do you need water? Well, you need water, fresh water for drinking, fresh water for cooking, fresh water for cleaning. If you live by the sea, then you've got access to rivers to navigate, rivers to trade. It's all to do with interaction and the growth of society. There's very sensible reasons to live by water. So you have all of these societies who live by the sea, who live by water, and they are susceptible to floods. They're susceptible to having their whole society being torn apart. Much in the same way as that you read in the modern day about rising sea levels and the danger that people suffer from significant sea level rises. Now, I want to talk to you briefly here about a Mesopotamian legend, which is made manifest in the Epic of Gilgamesh. So this is thousands and thousands of years old. significantly predates the Bible. And there's a tablet which records the Epic of Gilgamesh in the British Library. And one of the most important things about it is that it includes a flood myth in much the same way that you have the flood myth in the Bible. So we know by reading this tablet that fear of flood existed long before the Bible, and that it's further proof, I think, of the way that the Bible has taken stories from deeper in history and it's integrated them into a new whole. So that was one of the most interesting things I discovered whilst talking about the great floods. But apart from that, I've done all sorts of these wonderful things. Hadrian's Wall, that's about the fear of outsiders as well. The Great Wall of China, again, fear of outsiders. Though the Picts living in Scotland and the Xiongnu of the northern plains of China are rather different creatures. So, James, I'll leave it there. But, months and months of doing a variety of things, all of which are linked by fear.
Goodness me, I've basically been writing and reading about gloves all summer. I've been getting very excited about the... about emotional objects.
Hang on. While you're talking about gloves, right? I've got a new thing that I'm scared of.
Okay.
What are you scared of?
I'm going to talk about that later on. I'm scared. Scared of heights.
Okay. Well, I'm actually scared of heights.
Are you?
But
you go all sorts of dangerous places.
Yes, but you've got to overcome your fears. I'm quite like Aristotle in that respect.
Oh, I'm rubbish. I'm so passive.
My beliefs.
I give in to them entirely. Go on.
This is a new thing I'm afraid of.
Okay.
I'm afraid... You shall, my dear Emma, have no reason to be ashamed of your own Nelson. I send you the comb which looks handsome and a pair of curious gloves.
Ooh.
They are made only in Sardinia of the beards of mussels.
Ooh. God, you'd need to perfume those gloves, I think.
You would need to perfume them, but I am scared of gloves that are made of beards of mussels. Imagine having your face stroked by a glove made of the beards of mussels. That makes my skin crawl.
That's really, yes, that's a niche glove fetish, isn't it?
Anyway, I'm going to talk more about that in our next podcast, where we're going to be talking about humiliation.
Oh, lovely.
Lovely. A little teaser for you there, Joe.
Lovely. Well, I'm going to talk now about war and pick up sort of the mid part of that book on fear by Joanna Bourke. And one of the arguments that she makes is effectively that war, fear associated with war, has changed across the long 20th century. And what she argues is that you move from pre-World War One. You have much more sort of hand-to-hand combat, so people fighting sort of hand-to-hand. With the advent of technology, what she argues is that things shift, because when you are kind of pitted up against somebody face-to-face, it's literally either you fight or you flee, so fight or flight. And the natural response is basically to overcome your fear and to fight, whereas as soon as it becomes more mechanized, as soon as technology adds that kind of distance, there's a sort of sense in which you have that time to fear and to worry about what's going on. So with the sort of the shelling in World War One, the sort of distance of trench warfare, things become very sort of, there's a charted shift there. And then by the time you get to the Second World War, you've got the use of bombardment on cities, and war hits the domestic population in a way that it hadn't done before. And so you're dealing with fear and war in a very different way there. So going down to the air raid shelters and all of that kind of thing. And then in the post-World War II, with the invention of the atomic bomb and the dropping of the bomb on Japan to end the war, you've then got this sort of borderless fear of nuclear war. So something that is basically there as this sort of spectra of threat that will basically lead to, there's a big concern about nuclear holocaust and the end of civilization and the world as we know it today. And I want to talk a little bit about these different things. To start with, I want to talk about an example that heads chapter 7 on combat. And this is a tale of a young American soldier called William Manchester. and he finds himself sort of, you know, airlifted to the island of Okinawa during the Second World War. And he has to enter into an act of real bravery, because basically he finds one day that there is a sniper placed in a hut who is basically killing all the men in the neighbouring battalion. And he notices him in a fisherman's shack, thinks that he's going to be there. And he decides that basically we need to get rid of that person. So they need to find, where this person is. They need to go and find him. They need to remove him in order to stop this happening. Now, for him, we know this because of the personal accounts that survive. He's not a particularly brave individual. This is somebody who, you know, shied away from bullies at school, didn't get into fights. And now he is in a situation where he needs to deal with this sniper. Now, he could, you know, get the other men to do it, but maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. He could just timidly run away. But basically what he decides to do is to take this on himself, despite being utterly, utterly terrified. And he describes taking a deep breath and sweating with the greatest fear I had known till then. And he basically heads off towards this fisherman's hut, zigzagging, dropping down, sort of hiding every sort of, you know, dozen or so steps. He approaches the hut, realising that he's forgotten his helmet, which leads him into an utter panic. He's utterly terrified. And he describes, "I could feel a twitching in my jaw coming and going like a winky light signalling some disorder. Various valves were opening and closing in my stomach. My mouth was dry, my legs quaking, and my eyes out of focus." So we've got there the kind of the impact of fear on the body. And that's something that is fascinating. How do you recover that? He breaks into the hut, kicks down the door, finds the sniper there. And luckily, the sniper's rifle gets tangled in his harness. He shoots at him and first of all misses. But then, and I quote, "the second shot caught him dead on the femoral artery. His left thigh blossomed, swiftly turning to mush. A wave of blood gushed from the wound. Then another boiled out, sheeting across his legs, pooling on the earthen floor. He emitted a tremendous, raspy fart, slumped down and died." And in a panic, he just keeps on firing. He's gagging. And he writes, "Then I began to tremble and next to shake all over. I sobbed in a voice still grainy with fear, 'I'm sorry.' He then vomits, urinates, wondering, 'Is this what they mean by conspicuous gallantry?'" So there's a real sort of sense in which his fear, it doesn't stop him doing these kind of acts of bravery. But yet at the same time, he has this sort of consciousness that it's the wrong thing to do, that it's utterly terrifying. And his body just, you know, despite all these sort of tales of bravery and everything, it's a really sort of visceral engagement with war in a very sort of, you know, very direct way. And I think one of the things that the book argues is that war is a persistent feature of warfare. And there's a section where it looks at interviews of two combat infantry divisions during the war. And there's a series of interviews. And they found that 7% said that they were never afraid. However, in direct opposition to that, 75% of the men complained of trembling hands. 85% were troubled by sweating palms. 89% tossed sleeplessly in their beds at night. And this is something that psychologists, military psychologists, medical officers have had to sort of deal with throughout combat. How do they deal with this? How do they treat it? And fear in war is something that goes, that fear in war is something that you have to deal with and you have to overcome. And there's a sense that as we get a military that is less professional and a military that takes in more and more recruits, what you're getting is a more highly educated type of soldier who's much more conscious about what they're doing. And there's an extract from as late as 1976 in the Army Quarterly Defence Journal, which laments the passing of armies of the pre-1914 era. And according to this analysis, before the First World War, men were of stronger fibre, less influenced by cultural and soft social conditions, and often lacked the faculty for deep thought, which drew no picture of danger or feeling of fear. It might be said that such men possessed a natural courage, which really was a courage of insensibility to danger. So in other words, soldiers are becoming soft, and soldiers do not have that kind of battle hardiness that overcomes fear. Now, moving on, I just want to talk a little bit. I want to move on to talk about, I'm going to skip over the bombardment of cities, but what I want to do is talk about nuclear threats. And so the spectra of all-out nuclear war that will lead to Armageddon, that will lead to destruction, nuclear holocaust, fear of radiation poisoning, end of life on Earth as we know it, is something that haunted the Cold War era. As soon as the Russians developed nuclear weapons, there was a huge fear about what would be the result of that. And we looked at the Cuban Missile Crisis in one of our homeschooling episodes. But did you know that on the morning of the 8th of February in 1951, at 10:45, enemy planes dropped nuclear-primed bombs over New York City? A sixth-grade teacher in Public School 75 on West Eastern Avenue responded promptly to what was a sudden white flash, ordering her young charges to take cover. And children basically threw themselves on the ground, curled into tight balls, their backs to the windows. Within less than a minute, the attack was over. And do you know what this was? It was the first no-signal nuclear drill in America. It was something that terrified children, absolutely terrified them. Didn't know that this was coming, but yet, in early 1950s, this was something that they wanted to prepare for. The children hadn't been told, and it was really quite brutal, and many of them were really scared of this. And some of the teachers behaved in what is a sort of terrifying way. And one of them was yelled at a small boy during the drill, "Your arm is burned off, your right leg is gone, and half your face is burned away." And the child became apparently almost hysterical with this, because what they were trying to do was get the kids to take it seriously. And there's also an interview, a survey in the early 1960s, where they interviewed 350 children, and they were asked to think about, and I quote, "think about the world as it may be about 10 years from now. What are some of the ways in which it may be different from what it is today?" And without any prompting, 70% of these children mentioned, without being asked about it, mentioned the bomb, and either thinking that there was going to be some, horrific sort of life underground in a sort of post-nuclear world, or wholesale destruction. And one small boy in Chicago, and this is a quote that appears a couple of times in the book, in Chicago, begged his mother, "Please, mother, can't we go someplace where there isn't any sky?" And so what you have then, if we're thinking about these big changes over time, you're moving from hand-to-hand combat, you're moving to something, combat that is increasingly technologized, that is about, it's about tanks, it's about artillery, it's then about planes and dropping bombs on cities and, using the tactic of fear to fight a war in that sense, to something that actually has no global limits, that a bomb that can be sent, from the other side of the world, And I think this is something that we're seeing today. You know, we're seeing the, you know, early experiments in putting, you know, weaponry up in space as well today. It's very, very sort of very terrifying. But I thought it's fascinating to sort of think about that in across the sort of what the French historians would call the long durée, and think about how fear associated with war has changed. And you think about the, you know, you could think about this in terms of chivalry and codes of military honour and all of those kinds of things that are cultural, social codes, military codes that encourage people not to be fearful, encourage bravery, you know, the medals, the whole sort of material culture of it. But at the root of it, there is still this visceral, physical reaction to killing people.
Very good. I just want to, I'll sum up everything we've said, but I also want to just pick you up on a couple of things, which was really interesting. One was the poor chap in the Second World War who was urinating, trembling, and sweating.
Yeah.
And there's a history here of trying to explain the symptoms of fear. And I mentioned Aristotle very briefly, but he believed in balance. Everything had to be balanced. He believed in opposites. So if there was hot, there had to be cold. If there something was wet, it had to be dry. And he understood fear as almost the opposite of anger.
Hmm.
Where anger, you've got blood radiating away from the heart. You think of yourself being red in the face and being overtaken by a kind of full body fury. But fear is the opposite, he believed, with blood contracting towards the heart, making people cold, shivery, sweaty, trembling, and urinating as well was another symptom, which I think is really interesting. The way that it was explained in the ancient world, Galen, another Greek thinker, also believed in balances. And he believed that in some cases the balance of being able to control your thoughts and feelings, it was so sort of off kilter that some people even feared imaginary things. And what I quite like about this is the idea of who's to blame for fear. So in this ancient method, it's your fault because your body, not your fault, but your body is imbalanced, and that is the why you are fearful of things, rather than something happening to you by someone else, which really made me think of those poor children.
Yeah.
Who were so terrified of the war. And the fear of the kids as well, that's a really interesting history in its own right. And it really made me immediately think of nursery rhymes.
Yeah.
The horrific nursery rhymes where you've got, I found a little list of what happens to children on the British Library's website. So here we've got one single collection of nursery rhymes in the 19th century. It was analysed and it was found to consist of 8 murders, 2 by choking, 1 decapitation, 7 cases of severed limbs, beatings, falls, pecked off noses, religious persecution, plague and torture. Mm. You've got Cinderella's stepsisters who chop off their toes and heels to make their feet fit the glass slipper. Rumpelstiltskin, he splits in half when he stamps his foot in fury after the queen guesses his name. Wolves are boiled or have their bellies split open and filled with stones. There are cruel giants, shoes that dance you to death, wicked witches, murderous husbands, burials, ghosts, changelings, any numbers of curses and spells. And I think what's going on here, you know, this is a very different thing. You were talking about children and the war, but here you've got kids who, what are people deliberately using fear to control children? There's one story I discovered of a disobedient girl who sets fire to herself. It's very, very gruesome indeed in the history of the Fairchild family in just 1818. And this poor girl sets fire to herself because she's the flame catches her dress and up she goes. But in the same story, the children, these poor children in the family, they are whipped, deprived of food and taken to see a dead body hanging on display. Now, there's got a whole history of social norms and expectations here. And also, I think it's to do with religion. There's also a great deal of fear in religion. If you do not follow these beliefs, if you do not, and it's in this way, then these things will happen to you. And that actually is one of the reasons that stories of ghosts have survived. Think about what happens in the Bible. I mean, Jesus comes back to life. It's completely terrifying. And then he promises he's going to come back again for the second time. And this whole belief in reincarnation is very real. And it's also linked with this idea of, these poor people wandering the earth because they did not behave themselves in a certain way during their lifetime. So there you go.
I have for you, Sam, a quiz. A bewildering number of famous historical leaders have had fears. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to name the leader and you're going to come see if you can guess the fear.
Right, brilliant, love it.
First up is Franklin D. Roosevelt.
He was afraid of pigeons.
He was afraid of fire. And this can be traced, apparently, to when he was a young child. His aunt, Laura, came running down the stairs of the house with her dress ablaze from a spilled alcohol lamp.
Interesting.
So, yes. Genghis Khan, you'll probably know this one.
Oh, no, he was claustrophobic.
Ah, he may well have been, but apparently he also hated dogs. He was scared of dogs.
Wow.
Okay.
Okay, go on.
Kim Jong the Second, so North
Tweezers.
Korean dictator.
Tweezers.
Flying. Flying. Okay. Hated flying. He travelled instead on an armoured train. Even on very, very long visits. Next is Henry VIII. I'm slightly dubious about this one, but Henry VIII.
Flapjacks.
He was not afraid of flapjacks. He probably loved them. Apparently afraid of disease. It says. I imagine
germaphobe.
Most people are afraid of disease. Okay, next one. Augustus Caesar. According to the Roman historian Suetonius, founder of the Roman Empire.
Caesar. Yes. He was afraid of any animal that hopped.
No, he was afraid of lightning. He narrowly escaped a bolt of lightning that struck very nearby and killed a slave who was walking ahead with a torch. So he was very superstitious about that.
I could have got two of these.
Heraclius. The Byzantine emperor. Great victory over the Persians.
What was he afraid of? Light bulbs.
No, light bulbs had not been invented at that point. He was afraid of water, apparently. Here we are. Next up is Peter the Great.
Peter the Great. Wolves.
Very close. Insects and high ceilings. He had was said to have had a particular dislike for cockroaches.
Okay. Ceilings.
I can understand that. Yes, I'm not sure where they. A mild fear of open spaces as well. Now, next up, Winston Churchill.
Ooh, Germans.
No, this is a real teaser for you. Public speaking. The great orator was apparently. When he was a newly elected MP, aged 29, stood up to give a speech in the House of Commons and froze in utter terror. And then from that day on, decided that would never happen to him again. Adolf Hitler. And this is something I share with the Nazi leader.
Ooh, you share. You are afraid of... crowded spaces.
No, I'm not afraid of crowds. However, I am afraid, as with Hitler, of dentists. Hitler was terrified of dentists. And
he had terrible teeth.
Apparently, terrible teeth, appalling gums, abscesses and terrible halitosis. So really bad breath. Now, it's something I share with Colonel Gaddafi as well. So this is our last one.
Good. Tea bags.
A former Libyan dictator. I don't drink tea very often, but I'm not. True. I'm not phobic of it.
I thought you were.
I prefer coffee. But heights.
Oh, okay.
The man. It was terrified of heights. And the history of heights has a fascinating history. I was doing a little bit of research about this because I thought that that I had vertigo, and vertigo is in fact a medical condition, which is where you start feeling dizzy when you are up a height. But in fact, that's not what the fear of heights is at all. The fear of heights is actually acrophobia, which is what I have. A really weird sort of feeling of heights. And there are various people, across history who have, feared heights. Apparently, when Hannibal was crossing the Alps, one of the biggest enemies was the dizzying heights of crossing these sort of mountain ranges.
But I'm going to say he was afraid of elephants, which would have been a really bad
but
thing.
One of the weird things, those of you who, I don't know whether you said you suffer from fear of heights. One of the things is it's actually feeling that you are, it's not a rational fear. It is literally a feeling that you are going to throw yourself off. I was reading an article about this the other day. And, there is quite a history of people who feel that they are drawn to heights like that. It has a strange sort of response to them. It's something that the French existentialists, talked about being drawn towards the void. And that this is ultimately the sort of the real existential test of human freedom, whether you live or you die. And I've just been reading Robert McFarlane's Underland, which is a brilliant new book. He normally talks about everything above ground, about mountains and wild places. This is basically about what lies beneath our feet. And there are two brilliant chapters there, where one of which he talks about Paris and under the city in Paris. And he explores a phenomenon of urban explorers, these people who basically go into deserted urban cityscapes and explore underground, and also extreme caving and free diving. And one of the things there is about how people are just drawn to explore and drawn into these voids. And there's this one bit where he talks about being down in this cave underneath this mountain, and he goes down with a guide. And he finds himself at this sort of huge opening, and he almost has this out-of-body experience where he sort of gets sucked into it. So I suppose we end with the sort of the fear of not being able to control oneself.
Ooh, that's very good. Isn't that good? Like not being able to stop talking, James.
Exactly. That's something I'm never fearful of. That I can talk forever, for hours.
Wonderful. Guys, I hope you enjoyed that. I really enjoyed that. That was very good fun. We've got all sorts of wonderful things coming up. We're doing the history of humiliation and sharks and running away. Those are the next ones.
And leather.
On the list. And leather. we're both really looking forward to doing some research and entertaining you with some stories of unexpected histories. Do please check us out online at historiesoftheunexpected.com. Find everything that we've done in the past and our books and details of all of our fun stuff. Do please follow us on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis.
And I'm at James Daybell. And the podcast is at Unexpected Pod.
Do please get in touch and send us ideas for future episodes and send us thoughts on your own histories of fear. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Bye.
Bye, guys.